How is the art scene ticking? Everything we always wanted to know about art. This is the podcast of Petra Lossen. Today I am presenting you my conversation with William Stör. William is a US painter with international success. The focus of his work is the desire to explore fundamental issues of our time: intolerance, discrimination, addiction, violence, and war. Victims, witnesses, and survivors are his subjects. His works are deeply intimate portraits that evoke different deep emotions in each viewer. During the pandemic, William couldn't paint in his studio, so he started creating amazing digital artworks. I'm very happy to be able to offer you his digital artworks in my new online shop, which you may find in www.petralossen.com. During the time, we will add more and more artworks, but also other items in this online art shop. Hi, William Stör.
Hello, Petra Lossen.
Thank you so much that you take the time to talk to me for the podcast. I'm very happy about it, as I love your artworks. Your very, very, very special artworks. William, you are living in the United States, in Boulder, in Colorado. Yeah. And you studied something else. You learned another job, but you did not start with the art. So what did you do initially?
Yes. Well, first of all, initially, I did, in fact, want to become an artist. And I love the abstract expressionists. I loved Willem de Kooning in particular. But for various reasons, I didn't go on to art school. And, you know, I couldn't afford it. College was new to my family. And so I just really didn't know what I wanted to do. And so I went to a small college in Wisconsin and trained to become an industrial engineer. And so this was 55 years ago. And so my first jobs were with big industrial companies. And soon I left that work, and my wife, Mary Kay, and I started a mapping company. And we made hiking maps and maps to U.S. national parks. And then we extended and did maps in Nepal and Costa Rica and maps all around the world. And our company came to the attention of National Geographic. And the National Geographic Society acquired our company.
And so I
was working within their mapping group. And then after a few years, they promoted me to the president of the National Geographic Society's mapping group.
Great.
It was an excellent job, and I loved it. It was a dream job for me. But when I turned 55 years old, I turned in my resignation, and I quit the best job I ever had to become an artist.
Did you have the feeling, now it's time to be an artist? Yeah. How did you felt it?
Well, first of all, understand that I loved this job, and I could have easily retired in this job, and it was great. And my wife and I were living in the Virgin Islands in the Caribbean. We lived on the island of St. John, and we split our time between there and Colorado. And I just decided that at that age, 55, that I was young enough to start a new career. And why not do something that I wanted to do as a teenager, to become an artist? And so I gave them my resignation, and they asked me to stay on for two more years to select the person who would be taking over my job and such. And I agreed to that. And so after that period was up, I started to paint. And I actually started the paintings in the Virgin Islands. It was great. I loved it. The only problem was that I wasn't very good as an artist. And so what happened is I thought, well, I'll just understand. I hadn't painted in more than 40 years. But somehow I thought I could just pick up a paintbrush and start painting where I'd left off when I was in high school and a teenager. And of course, my first paintings were very small and very tight. But very quickly, I advanced. And, you know, it's funny. So here I am, here we are, we're living on an island, and I decided to paint a landscape, and it was terrible. And then I started painting some bodies, some figures, and they got better and better and better. And within a year, I had my first exhibit down there. And the paintings were very colorful. I painted dancing women. I painted some very colorful abstracts. And they were very popular, particularly with the tourists. And so my first show sold out. And this is great. But very quickly, I got tired of that kind of painting. And I wanted the painting to be more meaningful. And so I started to work some symbols into the work and try to take a different direction with it.
You said that the paintings were smaller and they were colorful. So was there a big difference to the paintings we know now from you?
Yes and no. My colors have certainly become more subdued. And so I don't use as much color for various reasons. And maybe we can talk about that in a little bit. But also the strokes were very similar. So very, very early on, let's say after the first few months, I started to really free up my style. And I started to pour paint on the canvases. I started to use these broad strokes. I started to really do a lot of things that my art heroes were doing in terms of the way they were using their brush and paint. I would even do things like, certainly I dripped paint, and I would just watch it drip and decide what to do with that drip then. I would even take a garden hose to a painting, and I was working in acrylics. And so before they were dry, I would hit it with a garden hose and spray it, or I'd pour water on them and I'd pour the paint. And so because I wasn't a trained artist, I wasn't technically trained in art school, or I didn't take any art classes. Mm-hmm. This was all very new. And so I just experimented, and that experimentation showed up in my early work. And then, of course, I've continued with much of that now.
You took your time, but as I understand, it was just, let's say, round about 1 year to feel absolutely free and to try whatever you can try on the painting and on the canvas. And how did it came that you ended up with your famous, well-known big faces?
Yes. Well, at a show at my gallery in Denver, Colorado, it was maybe my second show I had done with this gallery. It was a large solo show. And I was speaking to the gallery owner about my work. And I said that I was getting bored with what I was doing. And I was doing larger figurative pieces. And I also said that I didn't see a coherent body of work developing. And so each painting was a different painting. They didn't stand together as a group.
Mm-hmm.
And he said to me, well, you know, you really paint faces well. Why don't you try painting some large faces? And so that's what I did. So I started painting 4-foot paintings of faces, and then 5-foot paintings of faces, and then 7-foot paintings of faces. And I really liked it. And I have not gotten bored of doing the faces. And what I tried to do from the beginning was to incorporate the style that I had with these big brush strokes and to incorporate that into the faces. And I started to treat the parts of the faces much like an abstract painting. So if you looked at the forehead on a 7-foot painting, it's a very big forehead. And so I needed to be able to fill in that space with something interesting. And so I thought of it as a separate abstract, the same for the cheeks, the same for the chin, the same for the neck. And so I've always been incorporating these facets into my work. The other thing that I started to do is I started to look back at my favorite abstract expressionist artists, or not just abstract expressionists, but my favorite artists. And I would say, can I incorporate some of what they do into my faces?
Which are these artists?
Sure. Franz Klein would be a good example. And so here is Franz Klein doing these abstracts with these very broad black and sometimes red strokes. And I thought, how can I incorporate that into my paintings? So if you look at some of many of my paintings, you will see these big, wide strokes. And it might be strokes across the face. It might be how I've built up the neck. But once you know that I'm thinking about Franz Kline, you'll see how I'm incorporating what he's doing into my work. And so I will do that sometimes just as a challenge. I would say, how would Picasso do this when he was in this stage? Or how would Marlene Dumas, who's one of my favorite artists, how would she do this?
Yeah.
And so I've incorporated, for instance, Marlene Dumas likes to pour paint and move it around on these large sheets of watercolor paper. And I thought, well, can I do that on a canvas with watered down acrylic paint? And so I would pick up all of these stylistic cues from other artists and then incorporate them into the work. And not to copy their work or to make my work look like theirs, but rather to give me inspiration.
You are able to paint the eyes of these people in a very, very sensitive way so that the viewer just could start to cry. And I know that in 2012, your sister died. I'm very sorry about it, and I don't want to talk about this, but as I understood, it's a very important circumstance which changed you and your paintings also.
Yes, yes, that's correct.
Is this okay for you if you describe this a bit for us?
Yes, of course. When my sister died, a few years before that, well, it was very difficult to watch my sister's life be affected by opioids. And so we had many discussions and talks, and she was in and out of places that could help her, institutions, therapy. Mm-hmm. And then she had a couple of failed back surgeries. And so the opioids re-entered her life. And one time, very lengthy heart-to-heart over 3 days, I was kind of at wit's end. I told her that I would paint her portrait if she agreed to go into rehabilitation. And she agreed. It just came out of the blue, and I was very surprised. And so she was apparently in recovery for about 5 years. Well, then she had another back surgery, and she was back on the opioids, and she relapsed, and then she died. Mm. And so during this time, I was questioning the value of my art. You know, what good was it? What was I accomplishing? Was I really addressing the important things in life? And so I started to think about the very fact that when someone has an addiction, that it's not just the person with the addiction that suffers, and that there are, in fact, victims, witnesses to this addiction, and then survivors of it. And so my paintings became focused on victims, witnesses, and survivors. And at first, I was broadly looking at it, and I was saying, well, how about victims, witnesses, and survivors of abuse, or victims, witnesses, and survivors of violence and war, or and you name it. And people did respond to the paintings. But soon I said to myself, what do I know about all these things? How can I honestly, as an artist, paint someone who has is a victim of sexual violence? I can't. I don't know anything about it. But I did know something about addiction. And in particular, I was a witness to it. And so I decided that I would paint victims, witnesses, and survivors based on my experiences of addiction. And specifically within addiction, there's the stigma of addiction. And so the people that have the addiction feel that they're worthless and, as my sister said, evil. The people who are associated with them frequently are embarrassed by them. The medical profession sometimes discounts them. And so this stigma seemed to be the place to start, because the recovery can't begin until people don't have the stigma and can talk about it openly. And so that became the focus of my art. That was my mission.
I understand. And Is there a special technique you use to get these visual effects in the eyes of your subjects?
Okay, well, there are a couple of things. And first of all, let's talk about faces and eyes together. So we are hardwired to look at faces. Babies, when they're first born, look at faces. Our brains actually devote more brain power to looking at faces and recognizing them than to any other visual thing in our brains. And so, you know, we're born with this. So we immediately go to a face. Now, it turns out that one face is more interesting to a viewer than, let's say, two, three, or four faces, or to multiple people. And for whatever reason, our brains like to focus on a single face. And within the face, what do we go to immediately? The eyes. And so I knew that if I gave the eyes some sense of reality, that the viewers would go there immediately. And what I do, and if you look closely at my eyes, they're not like textbook eyes by any stretch. But within the eyes themselves, first of all, they're always looking straight at you. And so you have something that is called a shared gaze. And so you don't just notice the eyes, you lock into them. And I think you sometimes crawl into that person's head and look out through their eyes. And so I think it's a magical moment of this idea of a shared gaze. Then the other thing I do in the eyes, I always put some colors in there that are of equal value, but opposite on the color wheel. And so, for instance, there may be orange with like a purpley blue. There might be red with green in there. And I started to do that just naturally. I was just doing it. And suddenly I received a phone call from a neuroscientist who wanted to know why I was doing that and how I learned to do it. And it turns out that these equal value complementary colors throw our brains into a tizzy, and they kind of vibrate. And you can't look at them and really see them vibrate, but they're actually processed in two different parts of our brain, and they cause this reaction in our brain that gives them a sense of realness. And that was something I just discovered on my own. I didn't really think about it. And then suddenly I had a neuroscientist asking about it. So I continue to do that in all of my paintings.
So the way you are painting, this method you explore and the techniques you had discovered, they got into the interest of scientific. What was about it?
Yes. One of the first things that happened after scientists talked with me about this is I was invited to speak at a symposium, which was attended by neuroscientists from around the world. And there were about 400 of them in attendance. And so I spoke about my art and how I was using color. And during the course of this meeting, I had several private discussions with various scientists and have become very good friends with some of them. One in particular who's in London, he and I have visited on four occasions in London, and we go to the National Gallery together and we talk about art. And I had a show recently in London, and he came to the show and we talked about the art. One of the things that I have been attempting to do is to create a greater reality with the paintings. And my goal in finding this greater reality started, one, with my discussions with the neuroscientists, various neuroscientists, and then with one moment in Madrid going to visit Guernica.
Yeah.
About several years ago, I saw Guernica for the first time, and it took me about an hour to go inside the room, the gallery. And I couldn't do it. And I went in and I burst into tears, and I was alone in the gallery, and I could feel the flames burning my skin, and I could hear the screams.
Oh.
And it was a reality that I had never experienced before with a painting. And I felt I was there. It was just amazing. And I just became enamored, just so focused on understanding, how did Picasso do that?
Mm.
And so I've studied the painting a great deal and talked to my neuroscientist friends about it. And then, you know, it's a whole combination of things that he's done there that stimulate you. And you know, it's the black and white newspaper-esque coloring and little marks that make you know that this was an important moment. And it's in one corner is a Pietà, this mother holding her dead or dying child. And the flames and the soldier who's there with his sword and the bull and then the dove. And he's mixing three-dimensional objects with flattened ones. And he's doing all these things that just throw you into a jangle. But it was just such a powerful moment and one that I can rattle off these things and tell you what I see in the painting. But they still don't really explain how he caused that effect. Well,
yeah.
Part of it is that I mentally entered that scene. And so I began to understand that a painting that becomes real is one that I internalize and I create the narrative and I finish the painting. And one of my neuroscientist friends talks a great deal about a greater ambiguity. And he talks specifically about Vermeer's Girl with a Pearl Earring. And he talks about how you can look at that painting and you can feel really strongly one moment about the woman. And is she shy? Or you can look at it another time and you can say, well, is she exotic or is she being erotic? So any number of things that you can come away from that painting. And the way he has painted that has caused you to change your ideas about that painting. Once you enter into that narrative, and once you create differing narratives, suddenly the painting becomes more real because you are creating the meaning. And so that became very important to my artwork. And so my paintings, I strive for a reality based on ambiguity. So my paintings never have a background other than a color. And, you know, there's really nothing that's going on in the background that gives you any contact. The expressions, not always, but for the most part, are actually blank. And so I'm wanting you to create the emotion based on your own personal experiences. You create the emotion, you create the narrative, and then because much of the painting is unfinished, then you finish the painting. So you become very much engaged in that piece of work. So that's what I try to do. That's my goal, to create this greater reality based on your subjective interpretation, which you then reinterpret.
And you think the background would disturb this process?
Yes. Yeah. And I really strive. The titles of the paintings are simply the model's name. And if it's lane 5, it just means that it's the fifth painting I did of lane. And so I try not to give any context so that it's purely up to the person viewing the painting. Now, I do have some where the person looks horrified and between their expression and the way they're holding their hands, you know, something else is going on. But those aren't I'm not doing as many of those. And frequently I work in those hands with those expressions because I'm trying out something new. I'm trying to do more than a face. I'm trying to make it a little bit more difficult to do. And so I'll add these other features. But in general, they're contextless and they're very blank. There's an ambiguity and there's a lack of emotion, only so that you create it.
William, how do you find your models? Is there a person passing you by and then you see something in her face or in her eyes, and then you decide, I need to paint her?
Yes. And actually, some of my models have been models that modeled in a drawing group that I'm part of. And I like them as a model, and I ask them then to model for me in my studio. However, many of them, for instance, 1, 2, 3, 4 of them have come out of my favorite coffee shop. I'll see them over the course of the year and I'll say, would you be interested in modeling for me? And they always say yes. They understand I'm an artist and they know my work. Occasionally, I've actually asked a stranger to model for me. And I think there's been maybe three that I've asked, and they all modeled. And what I do is I'll give them my calling card and I'll say, you know, just go up on my website, see that I really am an artist, and you'll see the kind of work I'm doing. And if you're interested, send me an email. And those three all started modeling for me. And so I tend to keep my models for many years. And so most of my models I have painted for 10, 12, 13 years or more. And typically I get to know them. I get to know their family. My wife gets to know them. And we become friends. And so for a model, it's very important for me that they're interesting people as well, and that they understand what I'm trying to do, because I'm always talking during the modeling session, and it doesn't bother me if they move a little bit. And so it's a more open, fun relationship with the model.
Do I understand right? Your models, they are not victims or survivors.
They're not, that I know of. And I have no doubt that some are victims, witnesses, and survivors. And they may talk a little bit about it, but in general, we don't go with that during the painting session. We may have a small discussion. But in general, I really don't know their experiences. And I don't ask, and I don't paint them because I know they are a victim, witness, or a survivor. They're just a good model.
And how do you manage to let them look like a victim, witness, or survivor?
Well, you know, I give you a few visual cues.
Yeah.
Certainly focus on the eyes. And I do everything that I can to cause you to become involved with the painting. And I want you to say, well, what's going on here? Or you to say, how do I feel? And people simply create a reality, create these feelings based on their own experiences. That's the key to my painting.
Okay, so when you paint, for example, Nora, I don't know if you have a Nora, let's call her Nora now.
Sure.
So when I look at her, I see something different in her eyes than the next person and the third person and so on. Is this your experience?
Oh, yes, yes. And the other interesting thing is men see it differently than women. And so
okay.
And more often than not, women will react. Men will also, but it's a different reaction. So I find that interesting.
Absolutely, yes. And then there's a circumstance. You paint different women, but if you paint a man, it's always yourself.
Yes.
Why is it like this? Do you not like the men models?
You know, there's a couple things going on here. First of all, it's very easy to paint myself because I'm here all the time in my studio. I can do that. Right. But also, I am a witness. And so I find it powerful for myself to see my self-portraits with my other victims, witnesses, and survivors. So I am, in effect, witnessing this. And so that's why that's important. The other thing is, you know, I certainly draw male models with my art group, and I've never quite had the same sense that I wanted to paint them as a 7-foot painting, if that makes sense. And I don't know exactly why that is, but I'm always painting myself, and I've done probably 25 self-portraits, big ones. And they're all different, and I like that. And they're showing me at different times of my life. Sometimes, you know, recently during COVID, I've been going back to some old photos of myself to paint those. And it's fun to paint myself as a younger man and to witness my own aging. And so that's certainly going on here as well.
Yeah. And the next question is logically, this one, did this change you, that you paint yourself several times?
Let me tell you this. Mm-hmm. When I paint myself, I think about myself. And when I paint a model, I don't think about her. All I do is I paint.
Okay.
But when I paint myself, I will pause and I'll say, for instance, lately when I've been using some photographs of myself as a younger man, I've been reflecting on those times. You know, what was I like as a father? What was important to me at that stage of my life? Why did that change? Yeah. And so I have those discussions with myself. I don't know that I would have them as often if I wasn't painting myself. And that's been an interesting experience for me.
Yes, absolutely. I can imagine. Fantastic. And how is the reaction of your models when they watch to the paintings you made of them?
Yes. Well, it's, I guess if it wasn't positive, they wouldn't come back to model. And what's really interesting for me is that when I am with a drawing group, and not during COVID, but prior to COVID, I had two drawing groups. One was in my own studio and one was at another artist's studio. And the models would always be very happy to see the artists that had really rendered them attractively or well. And I always, in these drawing sessions, experiment. And so they're my time not to show the other artists what I can do, but rather to experiment and see if there's new techniques that I can develop. And so most of the time, my drawings of them are nowhere near as well done as the other artists, but that's not what I'm striving for. So it's interesting to me to see them respond positively to when someone does a really good painting of them. But when they're in my studio, they appreciate what I am doing. And so they're happy to have their picture taken next to the painting, which I like to do. So I'll post that on social media, and because people like to see who it is that I painted. And they appreciate what I'm trying to do. And that's important. So they react positively, even when the painting is not showing them in an attractive way.
Well, that's the point of what is attractive. From my point of view, all your models are very attractive, not in the common way, like the models for the fashion shows, but as personalities. That's my feeling. William, how do you know when a painting is finished, when it's done?
First of all, I don't think a painting is ever done.
Okay. Yeah.
And the reason is that even while I'm working on a painting, my mental image of what it is that I'm trying to paint keeps evolving. And so I finish a painting and I may like it for one day, and the next day I'm working on it again. And I tell people that if they have one of my paintings in their house, and if I come to their front door and I have a paintbrush in my hand, don't let me in. And so I am always repainting my paintings, and there's very few of mine that I would consider done. And that's fine. I have one painting in the house now, maybe two, that I've decided I'm not going to show and I want to hang on to. And I think they're done, but it's rare. And, you keep seeing different things in the painting. I keep getting new ideas, and I'll look at an older painting and I'll say, well, I don't like that anymore. I'm going to work on it. And during COVID, I actually had 5 shows during COVID, and 2 of them I attended, and I had maybe 50 paintings and several digital images that were being shown in various venues. But 2 of the shows were solo shows, and there was just a little break, you know, before the Omicron hit with COVID. And so I was able to put these 2 shows up and to attend them, but then attendance was very limited because people had to, you know, show that they were vaccinated and such. But I brought back to my studio about 50 paintings. I did this about 4 months ago, and believe me, I've started working on some of them. And it's just, even at the show, I'll look at a painting and I'll say, oh no, I've got to change that. And so it's all part of the process. And for me, the painting and creating is more important than putting it in a show and having someone buy it, because it's just this ongoing process. The other thing that happens is that my paintings tend to be series of incomplete paintings that I just paint one over the other, one over the other, one over the other. And so I get a depth to the painting. And the paintings, you know, I'll look at a painting and I won't like it and I'll pour paint on it. And so then what's left is a template for me to start the next painting. And so I've got all this activity going on the canvas that is these layers of paintings. And so I enjoy doing that. Now, having said that, sometimes a painting will be done in a couple of hours pretty well, and I'll like it. And, you know, usually it's each day is just a stage. I have a painting that is a repainting of a painting that I just started. But it's quite different. But I've probably got 8 hours in on it now, and I like it. It's actually a painting that I would put up in a gallery. And so that's maybe average. Sometimes I'll spend 40 hours on a painting, sometimes 8 hours, sometimes in 4 hours.
Okay.
So, you know, there's just no, it just happens.
So you never had a painting where you came to the point, this is ready, it's done like it is, and I never will touch it again in my life?
Well, first of all, I like to say to myself that I'm constantly in search of my masterpiece, but I'll never find it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because my ideas keep changing. But I have two paintings in our house right now that I'm not going to show anymore, and they're on the wall, and I'm going to keep them. And one of the reasons is, first of all, I like the paintings, but secondly, they're paintings that I think are done. I think if I were to add any more to them, I would ruin the painting.
Yeah. We had a discussion a couple of weeks ago where you mentioned that you are also starting to do digital artworks. Just a brief information for us. What kind of digital artworks you produce?
Yes. Okay. I've always done some things digitally. I draw lines on my iPad that ultimately end up on a painting. In my drawing groups, I draw on my iPad. But during COVID, my wife and I moved to Washington, D.C. part-time to help our son and his family with homeschooling and daycare for our grandsons. Yeah. And so I did not set up a studio. So I decided that I would work digitally. So I set up a digital workflow with my software, with my monitors, computer, and iPad. And I started to create what I call hybrid digital paintings. And what I did is I went back into my archive of images of my paintings. And when I do a painting, frequently, I take in-process photos of the work. You know, I'll take a photo after 1 hour of working on the painting. So I've got a very rough start to a painting. So I then take those into my computer and into my iPad, and I repaint them, if you will, based on that existing layer. So in a way, it's very much how I paint, with these templates and layers of incomplete paintings. So I started doing that again on my iPad. And so I've created about 50 of these digital paintings. And I've been creating some now, turning some into NFTs, been minting them as NFTs. And I haven't done a lot yet, but I do have about 50 paintings ready to go in this direction. And I've really enjoyed this. And because of COVID and not having a studio, it really allowed me to create in a new way. And while I can't draw do a big brushstroke across a 7-foot canvas, there's other things that I can do. And I'm learning a new skill. I can still work with colors. I can still work with my lines. I'm still working with faces. And so I've really enjoyed the process of doing this. Actually, there's one other part of this too, where I decided to do this because in general, I wasn't having opportunities for shows during COVID.
Yeah.
And so I thought, you know, I've got more than 300,000 social media followers why not create these digital works and display them online on social media? And that is important for me as well in this process.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah, I can imagine. I'm very happy, William, because we decided that we will work together in the future. So we will work for the digital artwork, and it's really fantastic. How about your new projects, exhibitions, and so on?
Well, I've just had multiple shows, both digital. So I've done, I had some digital work at the University of Michigan. I had digital work at the University of Colorado. I had some digital work at the Rocky Mountain College of Art and Design. And all of that work has come down now in the last few months.
Okay.
So I don't have any exhibitions planned. However, I am in discussions with various groups. So, for instance, the National Institutes of Health in Washington, D.C. would like to do an exhibition there about stigma. And they want to do that once we're really done with COVID. And so we've been talking about that and doing that together. But that's the only thing I've got right now. There will be more, but I just haven't been stepping out and making those connections just yet. It will happen.
Yeah.
I'll just put that on the back burner for the moment.
Okay. William, thank you so much that you took your time, and it was so interesting to listen to your art world. And I wish you all the best.
Well, thank you very much. And I'll look forward to seeing your podcast.
Yeah, me too.
You're right.
This was a podcast of Petra Lossen.